Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armodian. In this hour, is humanity the most damaging predator on Earth? Our guests say yes, and that its predatory practices may even be disrupting evolution. And first, under Richard Nixon, the U.S. militarized its response to its narcotics problem. Then it directed the response to Mexico. The author of a new book on the topic joins us to discuss this history and its implications for today. Why hasn't this policy of militarization succeeded in decreasing drug demand in the United States? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Welcome to Scholar's Circle. Two issues are particularly important in the last year in the United States. The first is the war on drugs as a justification for military strikes in the Caribbean. The second is the militarization of the southern border separating the U.S. and Mexico. Now, these issues are not new to 2025 or even just the past few years. There's a history of the militarization of U.S. drug policy and the impact it's had on its relations with its southern neighbors, and most notably Mexico. So on today's show, we will explore the history of the U.S. drug war, its relations with Mexico, and what the impact of this militarization means. Our guest has written a new book on this topic. Eileen Teague is Assistant Professor of International Affairs at the Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University. And she's the author of a new book, Policing on Drugs, The United States, Mexico, and the Origins of the Modern Drug War, 1969 to 2000. Professor Teague, thank you so much for joining us. My first question, I want to kind of set this up. There's kind of an assumption that the war on drugs has always had this military component to it, but that's actually not been the history if we take a little bit of a longer arc of history, has it?
No, it actually hasn't. And first, I just want to say thank you so much for having me. It's great to be a part of this conversation, both in a historical context and applying it into something that's very topical today in the media. And so, my book is looking at sort of the historical trajectory of the war on drugs, and it kind of takes it back to this period. First, very briefly examining the pre-1960s period before the Richard Nixon war on drugs years, and looking how the fact that drug enforcement wasn't inherently militarized and it wasn't inherently punitive, and it between 1969 and 2000, it argues how states made it that way, particularly the United States, and it showed how the U.S. and Mexican government played very active roles in militarizing their drug enforcement, drug control efforts, but with very different goals and imperatives in mind.
And I want to explore those goals. First of all, from the U.S.'s perspective, how much was Nixon responding when he's declaring the war on drugs to this perception about the proliferation of drugs? I think of the 60s as one where there was at least some cultural cachet, some cultural attitudes where drug use wasn't really all that bad. But it seems that Nixon was riding a wave that suggested that that should change.
Absolutely, Doug. I mean, we look at this period, even as recent, I guess, as the late 19th, early 20th century period, when the use of these psychoactive substances we now call drugs are very much associated with racial and ethnic others. Marijuana with Mexican laborers at times, cocaine use with Black laborers in the U.S. South, opium with Chinese, et cetera. But the 1960s represents this different period in which we see this proliferation of drug use among white, middle-class American youths. And that really inspires the law and order campaigns orchestrated by the Nixon administration to take a more intensive path against militarizing drug control, both domestically and abroad. And, what the book shows is that, one thing that a lot of folks don't know is the fact that the Nixon administration devoted far more resources to treatment than many people think. But it was progressive or successive presidential administrations in the United States, that were really responsible for, shaping and adding to the militarization of the drug war. But to get back to your original question in terms of what inspired this, I mean, it really was the rising drug abuse rates of the 1960s. There were, to an extent, veterans coming home from Vietnam with addictions to opium and other substances. There was widespread marijuana use among countercultural around those involved in the counterculture, hippies, those in the civil rights movement, that kind of thing. And it really then was molded when Nixon was running for president in 1968 as, part of this larger crackdown that he aimed to take on against disorder and crime at home. I mean, that this is where the war on drugs emerges from. But one thing I show in the first chapter of the book is how ne Nixon had his eyes on Mexico kind of years before this happened. I mean, as a politician from California, this these tales of marijuana and other drugs coming up from Mexico very much informed his views prior to the mid-1960s. And so a lot of this kind of came together into this larger law and order campaign that he ran in 1968.
And so, when thinking about drug use, the drug problem, I've always thought it was helpful and kind of framed as there's a question about supply, the question about demand, and the question about interdiction. Is it fair to say that, I mean, during the Nixon administration and really what you're describing here, the emphasis really shifted in the United States on how to address questions of demand, whether it's, criminalizing use, treatment, et cetera, and really shifted to supply, that we need to drive to supply? And if that's true, what ultimately is that motivation that it seems like there's at least some turning their back on? Maybe we should address the demand problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing I cover early on in the book is how, in orchestrating its drug control strategy, the United States prioritizes supply control abroad. And what this means is are things like you said, interdiction, using herbicides to literally destroy drug crops at their roots, eventually taking or embarking on these extrajudicial operations with organizations like the DEA and other policing agencies overseas, things like that. And eventually, as we see in some places today, kind of associating these drug overuse deaths, I mean, not as much with those who choose to use drugs in the United States, but sort of vilifying the countries that, that produce them. And there is a very sort of, marked break there with how the United States chooses to prioritize supply control in dealing with its domestic addiction problem. And so, while at times on the demand side, there is attention, government attention put towards demand, I mean, even before the government gets involved, I mean, addiction is highly stigmatized in US society. I mean, the earliest words that we have for communal organizations that handle domestic drug addiction are words that, are not, that don't necessarily conjure up a positive image, like sanatorium, halfway house, institution, drug farms, like things like that. And so we have this sort of history, and what I'm trying to show here in this period of time of really kind of putting demand options on the back burner and increasingly pushing more or putting more effort into supply. And what I tried to show over the course of nearly 3 decades with Mexico is that prioritizing supply, especially increasingly militarized supply, it works to make the problem worse. I mean, it's very easy to believe that, putting or applying force to a problem, I mean, it might achieve these short-term battlefield successes, which really manifests in the US government's prioritizing, things like the kingpin strategy. And so, but in the end, I mean, these are not long or enduring strategies that have worked. And then meanwhile, there's sort of this big elephant in the room that continues to be that the more resources that we put towards supply control, what's actually happening is it has no corresponding results on U.S. overdose deaths, and in fact, it actually we're seeing that in this period of supply control, overdose deaths in the United States are actually increasing, not decreasing.
And it's interesting because I think there's two levels of analysis here. One that you raised here is that it's not having anywhere near the effect on reducing drug use, reducing addiction, et cetera, that it had been promised. But I think there's even a more pernicious development here, With the use of militarizing the response, how much then is this motivated on the U.S. side? I'll also ask you on the Mexico side, but motivated on the U.S. side about militarizing Mexico's police, about drawing connections between U.S. military actors and Mexico's, you know, military actors, securitized actors, and giving a justification for the U.S., whether it's the military, whether it's the police, whether it's the DEA, to have a lot more access, you know, to Mexico, which would extend well beyond just drug policy.
There is a case to be made both then and now, you know, of the fact that more intensive drug policing can be used as a convenient excuse for other state imperatives, whether it be regime change, whether it be the United States at the end of the Cold War, where the geopolitics is shifting and you need kind of a rationale for more increased intervention. And so some people, you know, at the far extreme would argue that, you know, by the end of the 1980s, the Cold War and anti-communism is becoming less of an imperative for U.S. involvement in Latin America. So the drug war kind of overtakes that. And that's being the overall imperative for United States' continued presence in Latin America. Now, my book certainly doesn't dispute that, but I don't think that it would necessarily support the fact that this is sort of, you know, happening intentionally as we get into the 1990s and, you know, and onward. But I think that looking at it from both the U.S. and Mexican sides, and I know you're going to talk about the Mexican side shortly, but yes, I mean, I think that the United States uses border security and border closures that affect Mexico, you know, to show its partners both abroad and also people at home that it's taking a stronger action against drugs. Where the book begins with Operation Intercept, and this is a sort of notorious border closure of 1969, you know, what we have is sort of this first major case in which Mexico isn't even the predominant supplier of drugs to the United States. And yet, in this sort of very heightened media campaign at the border where it's closed down and you have these trucks that are lined up miles and miles, you know, down on the Mexico side to try to get into the United States because they have to undergo these exhaustive inspections for drugs. I mean, this is even looking at the fact that they're peeling kids' bananas looking for drugs for those that are coming into to school. That's how exhaustive it is. But this is sort of a dog and pony show in these early years. But it's not the first time that the United States would use drug control and the threat of Mexican drugs to take action and to kind of sort out its strategy on issues both inside and outside the scope of drug control.
So both the use of the military, because the belief that that is actually a way to try to stop the flow of drugs, possibly other reasons to want to militarize the border, that gives a picture of why the U.S. has embraced this. Why does Mexico embrace it? Why is there not more resistance on the part of Mexico with the use of the military as a way to try to root out some of these areas of supply?
No, that's a really good question. I mean, one thing I will say, and one more thing on the U.S. side, is that the United States really doesn't officially involve the military until the Reagan years, specifically with Ronald Reagan's 1986 National Security Decision Directive, which I look at in Chapter 4. Because before this, the United States has this strong tradition of respecting posse comitatus and the fact that the military really shouldn't be involved in domestic policing functions, of which drug control is considered, you know, part of those. So, I mean, that's just the fact that that changes during the Reagan years is evidence of how much the military's participation in drugs, you know, is increasing, you know, into the 1990s and, you know, and beyond. Whereas in Mexico, and this is kind of answering your actual question, the military has always been involved in drug enforcement. And at the same time, it's also been very much a tool of the institutional ruling party, the PRI. And so, you know, before the Nixon years, the army, who is the most, you know, well-equipped policing force in Mexico, is out on these long marches sometimes in these periphery spaces, disconnected from the capital, destroying drug crops with machetes, with flamethrowers, with things like that. These are pretty primitive anti-drug efforts. At the same time, the army is also sort of front and center of the party's efforts to crush dissent. And from the Mexican side of the coin, what I try to show in the book is how much Mexico, who didn't really have a drug problem comes to use US anti-drug resources from the 1970s and especially into the 1980s to increase its military capacities, for policing dissent against the PRI. And so you kind of had this really messy situation in which policing drugs and policing people in Mexico become very entangled in ways in which the United States doesn't always understand.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're exploring the history of the drug policy between the U.S. and Mexico, the impact of militarization on that drug policy, and what some of the implications are for today. Our guest is Eileen Teague. She is from Texas A&M University and has written a new book called Drugs: The United States, Mexico, and the Origin of the Modern Drug War, 1969 to 2000. So, Eileen, that argument certainly, it's troubling, the idea that the war on drugs is being used to undermine democratic developments in Mexico. And there's two developments then, in the book that you kind of highlighted that had some pretty profound implications. The first was the PRI used to win every single election, but then eventually will lose its political hold on Mexico. What was the implications for drug policy once the PRI no longer dominates Mexican politics?
Well, there are a couple ways to answer this question, and the answer is somewhere in between these extremes. By 2000, when the United States or when the PRI is voted out of power after nearly 70 years in power, this is sort of the origins of what the drug war in Mexico that most people are familiar with. But some may argue that with the turn of the tide in ruling parties, that the PRI had actually brokered agreements with some of these drug trafficking organizations in what is sort of called a Pax Priista of sorts, to make sure that these trafficking organizations don't attack people's families, don't create like massive amounts of crime in some of the bigger cities, and that these types of agreements were destroyed when the PRI was voted out of power. Now, I mean, some people have argued that, you may argue that, you may not. Another thing here is that the PRI begins to be disenfranchised really at the time in which Mexican drug trafficking organizations are becoming more senior partners in the drug trade to those Colombian organizations that had really had been at the forefront of the drug trade. They've been the senior drug trade, the senior partners in the drug trade during the 80s and into the early 1990s. By the early 1990s, you have U.S. Efforts, the South Florida Task Force that's coordinated under the Reagan administration with VP George H.W. Bush at the helm, destroying these trafficking routes in the Caribbean. At the same time, more or less, that with the creation of the North American Free Trade Agreement, you have an open trade bloc that is established between the United States and Mexico. And so, by the end, by the mid 1990s or so, everything is sort of being aligned, toward Mexico. And so, yes, it is a manifestation of the disenfranchisement of the PRI, but there's also larger economic and security forces at play at the same time that the PRI is being, that is not as dominant as it was in the past. I mean, I think one instance that comes up in the late 1980s is the kidnapping of the DEA agent Enrique Camarena in 1985. And eventually, by the time that this 3-year-long investigation, which is one of the DEA's largest overseas investigations, is concluded in 1989, not only is there lack of faith in the authority of the PRI, but you have these Mexican drug traffickers that are becoming more powerful, than ever. So it is about the political disenfranchisement of the PRI, but it's also kind of mixed in with a lot of other factors.
You highlighted economic factor, and this was sort of the second factor that you write about in the book that I wanted to also highlight, and that was the impact of NAFTA. And so I know one of the persistent criticisms of NAFTA is that by opening the border for trade, you're opening the border for the drug trade as well. First of all, is that an accurate description of what's happened since NAFTA, and how much then is this the economic reality of just, more open trade, more free trade, contributing both to again, the increase in drugs in the United States and the perception of the need to even further militarize the border.
I wouldn't say that's an inaccurate description. I think some of the forces are a bit complicated, but I think that what we've learned collectively with NAFTA, especially in the US-Mexico context, is that you can't selectively police, right? I mean, you can't police just the illicit economy and hope that legal trade is going to be sort of unperturbed and, you know, maybe vice versa. I think that, and one thing that's I cover a lot in the final chapter is how, you know, though NAFTA was conceived of by the Mexicans under the H.W. Bush administration, I mean, it was signed under Clinton, and you know there was a lot of buy-in for creating this North American trade bloc, but it was a challenge making NAFTA palatable to the American people in the lead-up period. I mean, you have two very unequal societies, and you have just 5, 10 years earlier, a DEA agent is killed in Mexico. We have news stories and the television news of, you know, these kingpins that are operating in Mexico. So we have this very dangerous society that is increasingly depicted in the U.S. television news media. I mean, just the news media, you know, in general. And so it took a lot to make NAFTA seem like, you know, it was executable in the United States. And part of that was very much, you know, an increase in border security, both in fortifications on the border, staffing for the border control, and, you know, and things like that. And so, you know, what I argue in that chapter is that, you know, free trade, the only way that free trade could be enacted between these two countries was almost paradoxically, you know, it came with an increased militarization of the border and in how both of these countries police the drug trade. You know, and for its part, Mexico is not a passive actor in this, just kind of standing and watching, you know, this happen. At multiple times throughout the story, either to make sure that the border isn't closed, with 1969 Operation Intercept, with taking a more aggressive stance against the investigation that's meant to find those behind Enrique Camarena, the DEA agent who was kidnapped and murdered. And in passing NAFTA, I mean, they at least ostensibly buy into this militarization on the drug war because they are dependent on the United States economically, you know, for these kinds of agreements, you know, like NAFTA. You know, but in the aftermath, NAFTA wasn't good for the majority of Mexicans. And I mean, and we have President Trump who campaigned during his first administration of how, you know, somehow America lost, you know, greatly as a result of NAFTA. And the manufacturing sector, for example, you know, did, you know, parts of it like the auto industry. But, you know, across the board, Mexicans lost so much more. And so you have the depletion of its agricultural industry, increased urbanization, you know, the fact that corn, which is a staple of the Mexican diet, is not being cultivated in Mexico anymore. It's being cultivated in, you know, in central United States. And so you kind of have to look, when you're looking at these periphery spaces that used to be these agricultural regions where we see increasingly these drug trafficking organizations flourish into the when the 20th century comes. I mean, we have to look a little bit more, in a little bit more detail, at all these forces that are occurring in the years and decades prior.
Now, you have this argument throughout the book that I found particularly fascinating about even the focus on the drug trade at its source was shifting the responsibility for America's drug addictions to Mexico. At the end of the day, if you want to battle drugs, you want to battle narcotics, that battle needs to be taken to Mexico. First of all, am I capturing the argument, you know, that you're making sufficiently well? And then secondly, about the implications now, whenever we speak of drug addictions, particularly things like fentanyl, the emphasis is very much on we need to put tariffs on countries to stop the drugs from coming in. And of course, you know, need to attack boats off the coast of Venezuela and Colombia to stop the drugs from coming in. Is this the origins of that, where America's drug problems, the answer to and the source of these drug problems really are international?
Yes, I think that there'll be a lot of people who agree with me in that. Yes, I mean that the source of America's drug problem is sort of a persistence in not really reconciling with drug demand at home and prioritizing supply control abroad. And so the book isn't, I mean, it says that. It doesn't really, it's not a book about addiction, so it doesn't really kind of tease out that question as much as it needs to. And I mean, even in just kind of taking that argument up until today, there have been some administrations that have devoted more resources to treatment. Currently in 2025, with a lot of the government cuts of the current Trump administration, a lot of resources have been slashed towards overdose and treatment prevention at the same time that we're moving in the Gerald Ford carrier group into the Caribbean, et cetera. And so I think that I would agree with you on that in terms of not focusing on demand has been the problem. But I think that what the book is really arguing is that focusing so much on supply has worked to make the problem worse. And it hasn't had any kind of impact on addiction rates at home. And it tries to kind of show how that manifests in the Mexico case. I mean, speaking hyperbolically here, if you go back to the days of the drug trade in the 1960s, there were some municipalities in Mexico considered it part of the local economy. There really wasn't a lot of violence that was involved with the trade. But when you put intense, when you start to intensify policing, with US assistance, what the mission is here is to show, that not only are we not really dismantling these drug trafficking organizations, we're making them more powerful. In taking the 31-year chronology that the book covers, I mean, I'm trying to show how this is happening not, once, but multiple times. And so when we get to a period like today and we're reconciling with the question of, I mean, is the reason that we are where we are today because we haven't focused on drug demand? And I mean, of course it is, but also the reason we are where we are today is because we're continuing to apply this military solution and it's creating a lot of these unintended consequences, which make societies like Mexico more violent and make the stakes of participation in this illicit industry, a whole lot higher. So in some ways, if you kind of look back and draw conclusions for that, these increasingly sophisticated drug trafficking organizations, which today operate like Fortune 500 companies, are, a thing of our own creation because they weren't that sophisticated back then. They didn't need to be. But these waves of applying military solutions and ignoring other possible solutions, or not taking a different stance on domestic drug demand, created the situation that we are in today.
Last question, and a particularly tricky one, but I won't apologize for asking a tough one at the end.
Love tricky questions.
And that is, you've described the problems with and the failures of U.S. drug policy because of the militarization. We're not getting the outcomes that we want with respect to reduced addictions. And one of the unintended consequences has been the increased militarization of Mexican groups, the more violence within Mexico. Right now, is there an option to back off of this militarized approach, considering that now the drug trade really is marked by so much violence? That is to say, this may have been our own doing, but can we get out of it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You're right, a tricky question, but I'll try to I'll take a I'll try to answer that as best as I can. No, I don't think that I think that we have I think I'm more of an advocate for taking a restrained approach. And a restrained approach doesn't mean inaction or passivity. It means weighing all options before touting you're going to land troops in Mexico, unilaterally without the cooperation of the Mexican government. The Mexican government is not going to allow U.S. troops in to be invited in to help police drugs. I feel like I find that very, very unlikely. But what we can do is we can try to use every option that is not, military force until we exhaust all options. I think that the current administration, with both advantages and disadvantages, or results and non-results, you have a lot of people in the Republican Party in the United States touting that we should deploy troops, send troops into Mexico to destroy the cartels. The administration of Mexican President Felipe Calderón in 2008, did the same thing, and it split up a lot of these groups, creating fragmentation and criminal infighting at the same time that there were increased border restrictions at the U.S.-Mexico border as a result of 9/11. So we have used the military. This is when we see kind of an upsurge in the homicide rates in Mexico. So that could be one argument in which the military has already been applied, and it created consequences that we could not foresee. I do think, on the other hand, that experimenting with different levels of strong diplomacy has been useful, albeit to different degrees. I don't agree with the administration's imposition of tariffs or the threat of tariffs, but it did force action on behalf of the Mexican government. Earlier this year, it resulted in President Sheinbaum mobilizing 10,000 National Guard troops to the border. What they were doing there, I'm not 100% sure. That's why I'm like, I'm not sure if that's good or bad, but it apparently is what the Trump administration wanted to see. And in August, when many people in the administration were talking about military force in Mexico, 26 drug traffickers got extradited to the United States. So sometimes coercive diplomacy does seem to have worked. But I think that in general, applying military force is not what we want to be our primary approach. I think that we want to get to a place where we are taking more of a root causes type approach and looking at some of the structural causes of persistent crime in Mexico, like why are young men, flocking to be part of the drug trade? What sort of structural reforms can be made to enhance the Mexican government state capacity? Because unlike, what you might see from the current administration in the news, like, not everybody in Mexico is corrupt, and this has been a country that, despite the fact there's been enormous violence, this is a partner, a sovereign partner nation, and so we should treat them, as such. And so they're also already we are might be kind of confused when we look at the news, and there's this talk of deploying military force, but the U.S. and Mexico already have ties and training between their militaries to prepare for different situations and counter narcotics. So maybe it's trying to strengthen some of those ties and not and those partnerships. As much as that might seem like a difficult thing to do, I think that there's some hope in doing that. But above all, we don't want to be using drug control, and I'll bring it back to the more current issues in the Caribbean right now, as a geist for things like regime change and other geopolitical strategies, because that in the long run is not going to work. We don't know that with a U.S. military intervention in Venezuela, for example, that things aren't going to be worse. And in the case of Venezuela specifically, what the U.S. military is targeting here with these boats are Caribbean cocaine routes, not the fentanyl that's causing U.S. overdoses here in the United States. So we want to make sure that we're very clear as to what, and we, the collective, we, the U.S. government, what it is that we are actually fighting for, because that's not always clear, like how much it actually connects to U.S. drug overdoses, at home, and what's the end state.
So ultimately, what you're saying, what would be a more effective policy would be greater restraint militarily, stronger diplomacy, particularly between the US and Mexico, and more of a commitment to treatment programs and to try to address the demand. And with that, I think I can absolutely endorse those as policies and concerns about the way in which the militarization of the war on drugs has both attempted to justify military actions as well as the increased militarization on the border. We've been talking about the U.S. drug policy vis-a-vis Mexico, the history of that policy, how it became militarized, and why that has ultimately not succeeded at trying to decrease drug demand in the United States. Our guest has been Eileen Teague. She's assistant professor of international affairs at the Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University and the author of a new book entitled Policing on Drugs, The United States, Mexico, and the Origin of the Modern Drug War, 1969 to 2000. Eileen Teague, thank you so much for sharing your time, your expertise, and this wonderful book with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed talking about it.
Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Is humanity the most damaging predator on Earth? Our next guests say yes, and that its predatory practices may be disrupting evolution. With us are the authors of the study. Chris Derrimont and Tom Reimken are professors of geography at the University of Victoria, BC, and Heather Bryan is a postdoctoral fellow there in the Applied Conservation Science Lab. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Heather Bryan, Chris Derrimont, and Tom Reimken. Great to have you here with us. I thought perhaps we could start with the origins of the study, which I understand is from this deep history of the idea of sustainability. Tom Reimken, this is your area. How did this originate?
It sort of is rooted in a field study that I began in about 1975 on a very remote lake on the west coast of Canada. And I was trying to basically evaluate some pretty basic ecological processes in this lake where I was studying this small fish called the stickleback. And I'd found actually there were about 22 species of predators that were utilizing this small fish. And they included loons and grebes and trout and otters. And I built up quantitatively a sort of a total consumption for each of these 22 species of predators. And very simply, I found that none of the predators really took even up to 5%. It was usually 1% to 5% of the prey population. And I thought that was sort of interesting that there were so many predators that they were taking such a small amount when it seemed clear they could have taken a lot more. And also, virtually none of them were taking the adult fish. They were all taking the young ones. This seemed to contrast dramatically with what I could see in adjacent marine waters where human fishers individually were taking about 50% of the total prey biomass, for example, of herring, of salmon, and we were targeting the reproductive adults. And this fundamental disconnect between us as a predator versus all these sort of natural predators, which obviously had persisted in these communities for a long time, set in motion the origin of this paper.
One of the ideas also pertain to how we define sustainability and how we research sustainability, according to your paper. What had been the general definition of sustainability with regards to these ecosystems before, and how had they been studied? Chris Derrimont?
When a new student in a fisheries class, for example, first hears his or her first lesson on sustainable exploitation, what he or she listens to is a model, an idea that speaks to sustaining yields to humanity, that is harvest, that is maximizing the long-term steady-state biomass that flows out of ecosystems and to human beings. And that's served humanity awfully well in the past few decades, but it's becoming clear that that sort of biomass removal clearly has cost to ecosystems. And it contrasts very much with the ideas that Tom just spoke to, and the idea that non-human predators, these natural predators, can serve as models of sustainable exploitation. After all, they've stood the test of time in, by and large, not having the drastic impacts on populations that we humans do.
And so when you studied the predators in terms of human predation, it seems you focused primarily on non-huge commercial types of farms, right? This is out in wild areas. Heather Bryan.
Sure. And this again comes from Tom's original idea that we might shift our idea of sustainability to one that involves looking at natural predators that have evolved for millennia with their prey as examples of ultimate sustainability. And so what we did is we compared the rates at which humans exploit wild species and compared them with the rates at which natural non-human predators in both marine and terrestrial ecosystems exploit wild species. And we looked at ecosystems spanning the entire planet, drawing on published studies over mostly from the 1990s. And we were able to compare both marine and terrestrial systems, which is something that many other studies haven't tackled.
So human predators tend to, first of all, be more damaging, seems to be your primary finding, than other predators. Let's go through all of why that is. Chris Dermott?
Humans have evolved culturally, technologically, economically, and so forth to become what we refer to as this super predator, this predator of predators, which is a key finding in our paper, a predator with remarkable ecological and evolutionary costs to ecosystems. And there are several maybe tipping point moments over time, probably starting long, long time ago with the development of projectile weapons, starting with simple throwing utensils that could dispatch an animal without having to engage with it. Predators lead very dangerous lifestyles in that they have to often physically interact with prey, and that can sometimes lead to their demise. So that was an early game changer. Let's fast forward to, say, the 1940s and 50s, where marine technology, industrial fish boats had the capacity to stay out at sea and freeze fish out at sea, was another game changer in that no longer would they have to cut their predatory missions short and head back to market. The fish could be frozen. And it's just hasn't stopped since then with global trade in seafood products, some remarkable technologies that allow us to search, pursue, and capture prey. I'm thinking, for example, of spotting planes that fly above the oceans in Alaska looking for herring balls and direct boats on the waters to those schools of fish. Thinking of giant nets that can scour the ocean floor. I'm thinking of, for example, modern projectile weapons that can bring down a large carnivore from almost half a mile away. These are remarkable technological accomplishments, but they've had enormous ecological costs to the prey we exploit and the ecosystems that ultimately support us.
Tom Reimken, what would you add?
There is, I think, two additional issues. That is the millions of years of adaptation that prey have coexisted, co-evolved with their predators have led to this sort of litany of huge behavioral adaptations, morphological activity. All of these things are basically to minimize the likelihood of the sort of a successful predatory event. But as this works, you know, the predators co-evolve. And so what we see in the real world is sort of this balance, this equilibrium. And there is no adaptation that any prey have that basically is free of our skill set. So basically, these prey here have now encountered this predator from which the last million years have provided no sort of capacity to cope with. The other thing that makes us particularly dramatic predator that differs from so many others, which I sort of, we both have alluded to here, and that is that we tend to target the reproductive capital, which sort of is this disconnect with what we find in the vast majority of these other predators, which are targeting the reproductive interest. And obviously the metaphor here is not that complicated, but it's quite profound, and that no system will persist if the capital is continually targeted. And that is the main target of our capture. And so this is ultimately sort of part and parcel of the complete lack of sustainability when we enter the fray. So
one of the things that you have found in your paper is that people target the large, the big, rather than the juveniles. Is that what you're talking about when you talk about reproductive capital?
Yes, it is. In fisheries, we have this concept called yield per recruit. And that is sort of, it doesn't make sense to catch a baby, you know, because if you let it live another year, it would be, you know, much heavier. And if you let it live another year, it's going to be even heavier yet. So you can very easily model a situation where what is most cost effective? Well, what's most cost effective is where you have the maximum yield, right, basically for any individual. And that basically is coincidental with the entry into the adult size classes, which is the reproductive capital. So it's the nature of our fishing science that almost invariably demands that we target these size classes just as they enter the reproductive class.
And so that, you're saying, has a negative impact on culling than other animals.
Yeah.
Heather, let's bring you back in here. So this is primarily hunters and fishers. I mean, what if we extended that out to other ways that animals were used by humanity? Would it just make the model go completely crazy?
It's kind of an interesting comparison. I guess if you think about it from the perspective of how we use domestic animals, we've selected for desirable traits over hundreds of years that allow us to benefit from products like milk, selecting for higher milk production, and traits that ultimately benefit us. Whereas in wild populations, we can see some effects of our harvesting that have potentially negative evolutionary effects on populations. So the sort of comparison, but also an example of how we differ in terms of different types of impacts that we can have on animals.
And what about the quantification? You had some numbers in terms of how different the rates are between us, the super predators, and others.
The most striking findings were from marine systems were that we take about 14 times higher on typically prey from the oceans compared with single species of natural predator, which is fairly dramatic. And that was just the sort of median or middle rate, and in some cases we take much higher than single species of natural predator. What was interesting on land is that although we didn't take more overall compared with single species of natural predators, we differed in how we take species on different trophic levels. So if you actually look at some of the large carnivores, we take up to 9 times the typical rate of natural predators. And natural predators on large carnivores tend to be other large carnivores.
There are two types of impacts that we've been talking about. One is about the evolutionary shifts. Another is potential extinctions. And then a third one seems to be about global food chains. So how could we break out these consequences from this super predator type of activity? Chris Darmont?
Clearly, human predators have emerged as a pretty potent agent of evolution, both in kind of the macro sense, in that overexploitation has led to a major evolutionary process that is extinction in many taxa over the last several hundred or more years, even thousands of years, since we've evolved as proficient hunters. But you've mentioned something really interesting, that is the more subtle microevolutionary changes, that is to say, changes that happen on contemporary sort of decadal type timescales, in which commonly, and especially in marine fishes, we're seeing effects like shrinking size at age. That is to say, fishes are getting smaller at a given age than they once were even a decade or two ago, or effects like shrinking horns on bighorn sheep and so on. And also in the marine world, shifts in reproductive schedules. Fishes are beginning to breed at younger ages and at smaller sizes. And all this is precipitated by the very different phenotypic targets or targets of selection that, that hunters and fishers impose on that reproductive capital, those large adults, which in effect gives a selective advantage to those individual fish that grow slower, that reproduce early and get some reproduction done before they enter the larger size classes and have very low probabilities of surviving another year. And I think another interaction between evolution and ecology, and that is when fishes in particular are breeding earlier and at smaller sizes, they tend to be less fecund. That is to say, they have less offspring, and that can have a demographic effect on populations. Populations that breed earlier because of our evolutionary forcing tend to be less resilient in the face of continued heavy harvests.
And so let's bring this back to where we started. Tom Reinken, let's bring you back. Given the study's findings, should we redefine sustainability? And if so, how?
Well, if we continue to harvest the capital at the rates we are, there is no such sustainability possible at a community level. We will probably, like we have seen, is a gradual erosion of the numbers of all the competitors. So we can maintain high levels at the expense of these other species. So if we're talking about ecological sustainability in the long term, where the entire community persists, clearly we have to do is we have to shift down to quotas that are representative of what we find in other predators, and that is typically less than 5%. And we have to shift to obviously the size classes that in fact are representative of what the typical sort of what we call the J-shaped survivorship curve is in so many fishes. So if we embed ourselves among those, then I believe long-term sustainability is probably a fait accompli. But without those changes, you can micromanage indefinitely, but there will sort of be no solution without those two initial changes that we've talked about.
Chris Darimont?
Yeah, Tom brings up some excellent points, so some guidance from non-human predators. That is, target the young if possible and don't take too much. These are simple rules that most non-human predators that have persisted in ecological communities for millennia or millions of years demonstrate for humanity. And I acknowledge, and we all acknowledge, and even in the paper, that there are enormous cultural and economic barriers against such shifts. But that being said, some fisheries show great promise in, for example, shifting the target of harvest to juvenile size classes. And in fact, the Pacific herring fishery provides a really nice illustration of what is possible.
Toward the end of your paper, you had a list of potential solutions, and some of them would probably need some explanation, like you talked about. Well, first of all, cultivating tolerance for carnivores, which I thought was interesting. Why don't we talk about that as well within this context? What do you mean by tolerance for carnivores?
We think the solutions are much more clear-cut in terms of safeguarding large carnivore populations into the future. Although there are economic drivers of those harvests, there is much more opposition to harvests. And that is to say that the social license that society once granted to trophy hunters, those that hunt not for food, but for trophy, is quickly eroding. And the global moral outrage shown after Cecil the Lion was killed sends a signal that this is indeed true. So what managers and campaigners and conservationists and indeed managers can do is help society change policy about large carnivore hunting to reflect what most members of societies believe to be a hunting activity that belongs in the history books and not in a day and age where large carnivores are so quickly disappearing.
And another potential solution that you put forward in your paper was supporting community leadership in fisheries. What does that mean?
In fisheries management, you can study the fish till the cows come home or the salmon come home, but often good management comes down to managing people. And in a global meta-analysis published 3 or 4 years ago, the common denominator in well-managed fisheries that haven't been diminished like so many others is local leadership and management on local scales. Decentralized management so that humans are managing resources in their backyard or back lakes or back near shore waters, for example. And they'll tend to make good decisions when there are leaders in communities that recognize the long view, a view that doesn't overexploit the reproductive capital at the expense of that capital for future human generations. So that would be another step in the right direction for sure.
Tom Reinken.
The method by which we could shift from the reproductive classes down to the subadults or to the juveniles. On our coast, we have one of the more commonly caught fishes are rock fishes, which reproducing at 15 years of age, but they can live for 100 years. And so we have to throw the young ones back and we keep the larger ones. But if you catch an adult rockfish, the egg production may be 2 million individuals, but when it was only 25% smaller, it would only have produced 100,000 or 200,000. So by taking out the larger individuals, we're effectively sort of collapsing the reproductive potential of that whole community. But the issue is how do you shift a capture technique such that you now specifically can target the subadults? And here we can have flexible hooks. You can have nets that basically allow the larger fish to escape before they're brought to the surface. So these are the things that I think practically the technology is already in place, at least in marine habitats, where it would not be technically difficult to gradually shift our demand into the size classes that predators are in fact primarily taking, and then therefore reduce the quotas accordingly. So those are the several issues that I think need to be addressed by society to bring the shifts in place that were postulated.
Thank you, all three of you, Heather Bryan, Chris Darmont, and Tom Reimken. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thanks, Maria.
Chris Darmont and Tom Reimken are professors of geography at the University of Victoria, BC, and Heather Bryan is a postdoctoral fellow there in the Applied Conservation Science Lab.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.